Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. Open your mind to a new way of living. timberliving.ie.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Let's have a quick look at the front pages before we meet our panel today. So the Sunday Independent have a poll, and according to it, half of adults aged under 35 have tried cocaine. Across the general population, it seems roughly about a fifth of people have tried cocaine or use it regularly. The Business Post: health overrun derails budget, and this has been going around for the last couple of weeks now. But they're basically saying that the health spending overrun is going to cause difficulties with new health measures being brought in, and B, is going to affect other things in the budget as well. The Sun on Sunday, what will be for some people the most important news of the day: Downton Hugh splits from wife. So Downton Abbey star Hugh Bonneville has split from his wife of 25 years. Sunday World is leading with that drugs bust during the week. And the Mail is leading with that very sad story about the killing an Offaly teenage boy on murder charge. And indeed, the Sunday Times and the Mirror are leading with that story as well. Okay, let's meet our panel. Gerard Howland is a public affairs consultant and columnist with the Irish Times. Niamh Horrigan is a sociologist and the Vice President of Academic Affairs at Mary Immaculate College. Pat Leahy is a former Assistant Commissioner of An Garda Síochána, and Louise Byrne is political correspondent with the Irish Mirror. Good morning, everybody. You're very welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Louise, do you believe those numbers in the poll on the front page of the Sunday Independent regarding cocaine use?
I do.
About right to you, yeah?
Yeah, no, I would say so. To be honest, I would actually say they're probably higher. I think cocaine use and drug use in general is very prevalent among all sectors of society. And to be honest, I was actually surprised by some of the age breakdown. It said that it was predominantly younger people that were using it. I think it was just under 50% of 18 to 34-year-olds that said they had either used it or they do use it regularly, and it kind of waned off then as you got older. I would imagine that's a lot higher. We know that cocaine specifically has been around for a very long time, and I think, you know, if you think back about the Celtic Tiger era, it was very, very prominent. So I would imagine that it's actually a lot higher than that, but it doesn't surprise me at all that people are saying they use it that much.
Yeah, I wonder, right, like, kind of without getting into things too much now, I think a lot of older people would remember cocaine as being a drug for a certain strata of society. Like, you got a rapid speed for a tenner that kept people out for the night. You got pills for 20, they came down to about 10.
You're using all the 90s terms, yeah, Brendan, you're showing your age.
But that was the reality of it. Niamh, would you not agree that, like, in the college scene back in the day, certainly, that cocaine was viewed as a drug for elites or whatever?
I think for many of us who went to college in the 90s, cocaine wasn't a drug that was widely used by students simply because it was very much out of their price range. That's most definitely not the case now. I mean, that's, for me, one of the single biggest changes is that, you know, you see fairly widespread cocaine use in the student population.
Yeah.
I think it's important to recognise, make the distinction there. So, you know, the poll is quoting, you know, figures for people who've tried cocaine between the ages of 18 and 34. There's a big difference between trying something and being a regular user. And loads of people try things when they're young, and not all of them go on to use regularly. So I suppose that's an important distinction. The other thing, I suppose, for me is, there's a number of articles this week about the potential of the fentanyl.
We'll come on to that. Let's stick with the cocaine for the moment.
But I think that you could, you know, at the end of the day, cocaine still tends to have a more middle class kind of focus.
Would you agree with that, Louise? I'm not asking you to compromise yourself or your friends in any way.
I'm nothing to compromise myself or my friends on. But I think predominantly,
is it a normal part of regular nightlife now?
Well, I put it this way: it'd be very rare to be out and not be offered something. Yeah, I would think so, and I would say that anyone out and about in Dublin now would say that. Now, of course, you say no or at least myself and my friends say no.
Yeah.
According to the Sunday time or the Sunday Independence, an awful lot of people
strangers
don't.
Kind of people selling, wanting to sell you stuff, approaching you like
like you'd be in somewhere, you'd be walking down the street and you would be asked if you want to buy a bag. Like that is, it is common. And I do think, I'm surprised when people are shocked by that, because I think there is sort of somewhat of a level of denial about how prevalent drug use is in Ireland, especially the likes of cocaine. Like, and it's been cocaine in the last couple of years, but like among my kind of cohort, my generation, say under 30, when I was in college, it would have been pills, and now that's being replaced by cocaine. So,
and cocaine, it seems to have become, pills obviously would have been a real budget drug next to cocaine. But I heard Nick the Talent saying during the week, I think that cocaine is possibly now down to 50 quid a gram. I'm not sure, but I think pills are still being used, but
I think it is very prevalent, and I think it is an issue that's going to have to be dealt with, because I think oftentimes in this country when we talk about drugs, we think of people who are addicts, we think of people who are living on the street, we think of these kind of people, but we don't often think of the people who are using it on a night out, or as Simon Harris said during the week, someone who's going down to the pub for a pint and then snorting a line of coke thinking it's okay. So I think when we're having these conversations about drugs, it needs to be kind of a wider, more holistic view of it, rather than just the people who are down and out. Of course, they have to be considered as well.
The ethical consequences of the decisions of using cocaine could be pushed much harder in the public health debate, I think.
Pat, is there an element, you've seen these things come and go and come back in down the years. Is there an element that is generational? I sometimes wonder if cocaine has a moment and then people maybe see the damage done to people in their lives by it. It goes out of vogue for a while and then it bubbles back up for a new crowd who have not seen maybe the aftermath of it sometimes.
It has been the trend previously.
Yeah.
But you can't argue with the stats we're looking at this morning, because if we look at the international research, we're number one in terms of cocaine use in the European Union. Ireland is the number one in cocaine use in the Europe. What kind of a statement is it? That's a sad statement to have to make. We're number four in the world, according to the United Nations, the Office on Drugs and Crime. Number four in terms of usage of cocaine in the world. So that's what's out there from a research perspective. If you look at the treatment centres here, they'll tell you that they're presenting now for cocaine more than any other drug at the moment. It is the number one thing that they're presenting for in terms of treatment. All strata in society is affected by it now. Whereas there was a time when you could look at what you're describing previously, at a certain strata in society, we associated with it, not anymore. It's across all strata in society. And the seeds are being sown in their early teens. Okay, there's a graduated, I suppose, introduction to cocaine. But cocaine is freely available now at the moment. And it's very, very timely that we're having this conversation. And those two statements about the United Nations and the European Union are really, really thorny elements of cocaine here, and it needs to be discussed now in the context of what happened during the week, because what happened during the week has kind of been consumed as a Netflix story almost, like, you know, and it's exciting, but it's not actually getting to those two really sad statements about our country, you know, where we are in terms of cocaine usage at the moment.
Gerard Howland, what do you think?
Well, I just, that word pills, I hadn't heard that for a very long time in that context, but it brought it back to me because it was a word very in vogue when I was around in clubs. And the other word for pills at the time was yolks. Yeah. It's another era now. But clearly, on the base of these statistics, but also, as Pat said, what the international agencies are telling us, we have a huge problem. It's sort of like a degree of drink. It's contained up to a point. But of course, some people breach the boundaries of containment. They end up in treatment centres, and before they get there, they're doing a lot of damage to themselves, to others, and to the wider society. And that boat off the coast of Wexford was there for a purpose. It was to sell very valuable goods.
Okay, so Niamh, let's go back to what you were saying about the notion of the discussion around drugs. So it is a complicated discussion, right?
It
on
is.
One hand, we have people saying, well, addiction is a medical issue and it is not a criminal law issue and everything. You were saying, though, we need to broaden this out into a discussion on, is this about people who are using drugs but who are not going to become
Yeah. So I think for people who are the category that Jared was just talking about, there are people who are using, who never end up in addiction centres and just kind of trundle away through their lives, but really don't see. So there's a small cohort of, say, if we take the drugs industry as an industry, it's very organised. There's people making huge amounts of money out of it. There are certain pockets of small communities in Ireland who are very oppressed still because criminals have a stronghold in those communities, and they use, and the consequences of those for those communities are absolutely devastating. And it's always concerning to me. Like when I was small, women still wore real fur coats, and you know, PETA made that an unethical choice, so nobody ever wears a real fur coat now. But at the same time, you will see people doing lines of coke at the weekend while buying fair trade coffee and fair trade chocolate and fair trade bananas. So understanding that their consumption has consequences in terms of their cup of coffee, but not necessarily in terms of their line of coke. And I mean, that is something that, I mean, somebody...
So if you're woke, don't do coke.
Correct, Brendan. That's what the public health line should be being pushed much harder at the moment, because I think there is an openness to those ethical conversations, particularly amongst that conversation, that that generation, that there actually may not have been in earlier generations.
So if you reframe how they're thinking about it. By the way, I just wanted to say that that poll that came up with that figure in the Sunday Independent was a text-based poll conducted on Thursday and Friday last, the 28th and 29th. The sample size was 1,196 and the margin of error was plus or minus 2.9%. So it would strike me that you're also potentially, though, moving us to another conversation that it's been ongoing over the weekend in the Citizens Assembly and everything. Is all of this an argument for legalising drugs? Louise, what do you think?
It hasn't been something I've given a whole lot of thought to, and I'd be very interested to see what the Citizens Assembly on drugs has to say. But I mean, I think primarily you have to look at it from the two points of view, from the health point of view, because addiction is a real issue, and we've seen the issues that addiction can cause for our health service and all the rest of it. But at the same time, should there be a criminal element to it? We've seen the damage that it can do to communities, like Niamh said. We've seen the issues, especially in this city, in Dublin, that drugs can cause. So I think it's a hard one, and I think it's going to be interesting to see what the Citizens Assembly say and then what the government actually does, because I think whatever they do, neither choice might not be popular.
Pat?
Well, there's the difference between legalisation and decriminalisation, and they're two sides That's of a important. Very different argument. So from a decriminalisation point of view, I do think there's room for further exploration there, and I would probably support some move in that direction, because when you're talking about decriminalisation, you're talking about those who are already addicted. And a policing response to that is going to have no effect. Police action never cured drug addiction.
Apart from to push them into the prison system, possibly a university of crime and a life sentence down a particular road in life, potentially.
And there's another aspect to that as well, Brendan, because that, generally speaking, ends up in warrants being in existence for drug addicted people, because they can't go to the courts. They can't go for treatment, because in order to do that, they have to, you know, come above the parapet again and become visible to everybody.
Okay.
Now, there has been success in outreach programs, including the police, you know, to try and address some of that, to get people into treatment. So, look, for me, the decriminalisation is something that we probably should realistically explore. That would bring us in to the supervised injection centres, which there's already space for that now here in Ireland, but they're having problems with the planning of it. But that requires some decriminalisation within a certain, I suppose, area around that particular place. So I would support that. Okay, legalisation is a very different animal altogether, which I would say no, that is just going to keep problems on our problems.
We're potentially saying here, George, don't throw the book at people who have a drug problem, but at the same time, do not maybe encourage or legitimise people who are dabbling in drugs by making it, by decriminalising it.
Several days a week, I would walk up and down Usher Quay and Wood Quay, where the drug treatment centre is, and you see a lot of people who are clearly in the throes of addiction. And the idea of arresting them, it seems to me absolutely pointless. And Pat would know that the people I'm talking about, they are in deep problem space, regards themselves. They have little capability, it seems to me, for self-help. The fact that we haven't opened up injection centres, I think, is a big issue for us as a society, for us as a community. I can readily understand that nobody would particularly want to be adjacent to one, but we desperately need them. And I think that has to be a priority. And in relation to people who have drug problems, I think arresting, it's beyond the point where arresting and criminality is of much help. But I think to throw the baby out with the bathwater and to decriminalise, I think, what would that open us up to? I could only imagine.
Yeah, Niamh, from a sociologist's point of view, what would it open us up to?
I suppose the issue is, from a broad moral standpoint, that if everybody, say, in Europe, in the European Union, were to legalise tomorrow, and every country universally took the same decision to legalise at the same level, then it could be something that you could explore. The problem is, if you are an individual country within the European Union who goes down a legalisation route, you then, and the Netherlands are a very good example
become
of this,
a holiday
you become a hub, essentially, yeah, in an organised crime network. And it was, from my point of view, I think this kind of feeds into what Pat was saying, it's not a black or white question. There's a gradation here where, at the upper level, if you were pumping drugs into a community, by sure, you are a criminal and you should be arrested, whether yeah. you're using or not yourself. But if you're a vulnerable person on the street who's homeless, who's using, you're a victim. Do you know what I mean? That's not a crime.
Do we know if drugs are decriminalised or indeed legalised? So say the so-called softer drugs like marijuana and that. Do people take more drugs or not? Do we know that?
There's a lot of... The evidence, as far as I'm aware, is quite mixed on that. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And certainly there would seem to be areas where you get, I mean, the States is a really interesting example of that, where you have states who have moved further down the decriminalisation route. But then you also see some states who have really pushed back and become hard. And you also see this in the Netherlands, actually, that there are some parts of the Netherlands that have become kind of quite conservative and quite anti-drugs as a result of the kind of policies that they've had. So it can have a polarising effect. But certainly, I would be very much in favour of a decriminalisation approach, which really kind of, when it converges with our housing crisis at the moment and our homelessness crisis, it's mad. And it's also I know we'll talk about this, the guarding resourcing issue later. It's absolutely impossible for the Gardaí to lock up every single person who's using drugs in Ireland. Mm. That's an impossibility. And it's about using resources strategically, and the yeah, current system okay. is a waste in that sense. Yeah.
Louise, there's a text here. A lot of the cocaine thing has to do with, quotes, health and wellness. I see it amongst my co-workers who use it casually at weekends. They see alcohol as an unhealthy choice due to calories and weight gain, etc. Is that part of this?
I mean, not that I've heard of. That kind of seems a little bit bananas, really, doesn't it? I mean,
I have heard this said, and also, like, I think a lot of teenagers now are drinking spirits as well. That they yeah. it's a cleaner thing and less weight and all that.
Yeah,
and
a lot of my friends will drink spirits, so they don't. I'm not a huge drinker, but I have been told by my friends that they would drink spirits because it's less calories. But I mean, if you're using cocaine rather than drinking, I mean, you're putting things that are as bad, if not worse, into your body. So if you're doing it for health and wellness point of view, you might need to do a little bit more research on that one.
Yeah. Now, back so to the fentanyl, and Gerard and Niamh, you both picked a piece by Colin Murphy here. We missed the boat on the heroin crisis. Let's not do that again with fentanyl. Gerard, do you want to just tell us about that?
Well, there was just, it's the scale of this in the United States. It's an opiate-based, it's a painkiller, it has medicinal purposes, and it is potentially 100 times stronger than morphine. I mean, I had a morphine injection once in my entire life, and it was a complete unforgettable experience. Mm-hmm. And the idea that there's something that is volumes more powerful than it, and it's been taken as a sort of recreational drug, and the scale of devastation in the United States is just simply staggering. You know, there were 75,000 overdose deaths linked to opiates in 2021. You know, we're a smaller country, but if you multiply or divide those numbers into here, and the social chaos it would cause, because you're dealing with people on drugs that put them beyond, in their headspace, even the headspace they're in now with what they're on at the minute.
Yeah, Niamh, so it seems to be that the background to this is that because of like a clampdown on maybe the poppy farming in Afghanistan, yeah, etc., this cheap synthetic fentanyl from China has taken over the market. But it is a completely different ballgame to, you don't want to say your ordinary decent heroin, but it does seem to be at another
it's
level.
It's in a completely different league. I had a conversation with somebody during the week who has family living in San Francisco, and San Francisco has been destroyed. By fentanyl, absolutely destroyed by fentanyl. And I suppose the difficulty for us, and I think that's why Colin Murphy's piece is very interesting, he was highlighting that before the heroin crisis really blew in North Dublin in the kind of late 70s, early 80s, you had communities of people who were very vulnerable. That essentially heroin moved in. And we are in the same boat in the sense that in our inner cities, we have incredibly vulnerable communities. We have a lot of people who are living in the margins. Like, if you think about it, if you're homeless on the streets of Dublin right now, wouldn't you love something that would just make it all go away, completely zone you out? But I mean, this combined with our housing crisis could be really, I think, a challenge that we have not seen before.
Yeah, and also there's a ready-made market there for fentanyl.
For sure.
But whereas like people had to get addicted to heroin in the first place. Pat, do you remember the dynamics of how heroin come in and how quickly it spreads and everything? Like, if fentanyl comes in, will it be like a bomb going off?
It could spread more quickly than heroin ever did, because heroin was confined for decades into little pockets, you know, where social deprivation was the order of the day. I mean, from the North Inner City perspective, it really took hold after the dockers were all laid off, because, you know, dealing with the ships as they pulled up change from manual labour to different types, different styles of mechanisation, etc., and all these people were laid off. So that part of the city was destitute, you know. Heroin got its foothold in there, and it's still there. It's still a huge problem in there. But Tony Gregory raised that at the time, and in the story that's in the papers this morning, that was disclosed to Charlie Haughey at the time, and he promised that he would, and they actually believed that he would. But then, of course, we had other scandals that, you know, were uncovered at that particular time, and he never got back to it. That's basically what they say about it this morning. This is coming. We know it's coming. OK, it is going to ravage our communities unless we prepare for it. Now, you might ask me, how do we prepare for it? We certainly have to get it on the table and first acknowledge that it's going to happen. The Taoiseach this week came out and said, we better get ready for this. Now, that requires action for sure. But this stuff, I mean, it is a painkiller. You get it on prescription in the States. So like, it's been given out by doctors, but it is so effective for those that are addicted to drugs, in particular heroin. It is just off the scales, and absolutely right. 75,000 people in 2022 drug overdose occurred associated with.
So we don't think this is Canada's ravaged wild at the moment. Tactics.
No, it absolutely is not. This is real. Very real.
Okay. On a kind of analysis level of this, then Niamh and George, you both picked a piece in the Sunday Business Post. It's the editorial, "Drug Seizure Highlights Unvarnished Truths About Ireland's Security Forces." George, do you want to tell us about that?
Well, first of all, there is no security answer to the drug problem, so I don't want to look at that through that prism. But there is a major security issue. It's been well documented in terms of our defence forces, particularly the Navy. There are fewer than 800 people in the naval service. We can put, if we're on a good day, we can put two boats out to sea. We have no capacity to monitor what's going on underneath the surface of the water. We have no capacity in terms of our tiny, effectively nearly inoperative air force to monitor anything in our airspace that does not voluntarily turn on its own radar. Now, this has ramifications far beyond drugs, but in relation to drugs specifically, it's another aspect of an almost defunct capacity in the air and at sea.
Niamh, you picked that as well.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because the drug seizure has resurfaced a lot of debates which we just had 6 months ago when the neutrality issue surfaced. And it's basically about, if you're credibly neutral, then you do really have to have some capacity to defend yourself. Bear in mind, we haven't had a full minister for defence for some years at the cabinet table. It's been a
2011,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, it's been folded in to other portfolios and not to its betterment, I think it has to be said. And really what this is highlighting, I mean, the challenge for us, aside from the local policing issue, has always been that, unlike so many other countries, we have this enormous and very complex coastline, which is really challenging to monitor. But we do at least have to start to make some credible attempt at that.
Now, Pat, the Tarnished, I think it was, said this week that what happened during the week, that bust, is proof that we are not a soft touch and we are not a easy access route to Europe.
Look, you have to look at what's happening in the background, stuff that we don't see. I mean, there's a huge positive story coming out of what happened during the week. And I'll just use my...
Before you do that, we'll bear in mind that there are people up on charges, so we will
absolutely. I mean, look, yeah. In terms of the capacity of our special services, both on the Garda side and on the defence side, proved that they can do what everybody else in the world can do. Highly trained, top class, a manoeuvre that's fit for TV. In fairness to the Ranger wing, absolutely textbook stuff. And all really, really excellent. And that's because they train with the world's best as well, regularly, as do the Garda Síochána, their armed services, and the Navy. The Navy have been top class over the years. This is not the first time that they've done these interdictions at sea, but it is the first time we've actually fast-roped onto them. But that shows what they can do. The sad part of it is they can only field 2 ships out of 8 at any given time. And the second ship, they're not sure whether or not it'll be full of trained permanent staff or whether it'll be Slough Marie on board as well. That's an issue that we have. But the Defence Forces over the last decade or so has been wound down to a certain level. And when you wind them down as quickly as it was done, it's very, very difficult to wind it back up again. The paying conditions has been an issue for years. There's nothing to attract people in from a finance perspective. And until we address that properly, people are not going to go in. We're at full employment, almost as it is at the moment. There's no attractiveness in that, okay, as there's not in an Garda Síochána.
Going back to the operation, or more what led to the operation and everything. So is this something that's happening all the time, where international gangs come together, deal with a cartel, and then the big operation comes up and shares it out around the place? Is that the playbook?
Yes, yeah, they're acting like a company. They're spreading the risk. So if they're all contributing to this, once it goes belly up for 152 million or 157 million, they only have a certain slice of it that they're losing. So it's not a huge hit for any single cartel, depending on the percentage that they've invested in it. But they have to buy the ship, they have to buy the trawler that we found off the Wexford coast, still on the sandbank 5 miles off, you know, which is a little bit laughable, really. But apart from that, they're investing in this. These cartels are like international companies. They have their finance aspect to it. They have their lines of communication up and running. They're paying off various different people across the routes that they're using to get in and out. So they have a network, and they have a structure to their companies, their drugs companies, which is how it now, in terms of enforcing, you know, standards, that's done at the barrel of a gun or at the end of a baseball bat and so on and so forth. It's not any normal company. So the police have to be similar in terms of their integrated nature internationally, and we're very well integrated now at the moment. And even the last 12 months shows that, with the US coming out and putting a bounty on 5 of the key or 7 of the key people that we want internationally. The commissioner being photographed with in the EAU recently, or in the United Arab Emirates recently. That's a real strong signal internationally.
Okay, so it's an international response to what has become an international business.
Absolutely. You know, here, but Interpol are on their way over. Part of this information and intelligence piece was with Europol. So all of the international agencies, the DEA in the States were involved in this. The UK Crime Agency was involved in this. So this is a real international approach at policing. And this is never going to end now. This is the new a form of policing internationally, integration of effort.
Okay, we'll take a break. Louise Byrne, Pat Leahy, Niamh Horrigan and Gerard Howland staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. 25 years supplying stylish, durable log cabins. Timberliving.ie.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Louise Byrne, Pat Leahy, Niamh Horrigan and Gerard Howland are still with us, and we'll move on to the budget, a much talked about budget, Louise. So the front page of the Business Post, health overruns derail budget.
Yeah, so I suppose we are now 9 days away from the budget, and in really to the business of it this week was ministers meet Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath. And I suppose while we know some bits, a lot of it's still up in the air. Like, we know things like there's going to be a tax package. It's likely that that 40% tax rate level will go up so that people pay it at a higher level of earning.
Up by 1,500, it seems, the talk.
We don't know. Like, I'm hearing Fine Gael wanted up to 45,000, up from 40. Like, I'm hearing all sorts. That would be a bit of a jump compared to what they did last year. But we don't really know. We know that there's going to be some kind of cuts to the USD. We know that there's going to be some sort of energy credit. It won't be as big as last year. Some sort of mortgage interest relief. We still don't know exactly who that's for. Michael McGrath is kind of indicating in a number of the papers this morning it will be for the most hard pressed. But I think what is at the back of everyone's mind is what the Business Post have on their front page today, and that is that health overrun. We're being told a near 2 billion euro overrun into the Department of Health, which is of course Stephen Donnelly's department. And what a lot of ministers are saying, and Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath were saying this last week, is that the level of spending in the Department of Health is a risk to everyone else's budget. You could be talking about Roderick O'Gorman's budget and childcare, you could be talking about the energy credits, you could really be talking about anything, you could be talking about the tax package. So I think that is a risk, and I think Stephen Donnelly is going to come under a lot of pressure this week. I understand he has his bilateral meeting with Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath, and one would imagine it's going to be very tough.
Have been slightly tense public comments by the two finance ministers, haven't there?
Yeah, there have been. We had Michael McGrath and Pascal Donoghue out one day during the week within about an hour of each other, and they were both saying that the Department of Health overrun is a real risk. It is a real issue. I suppose at this stage, they're trying to manage expectations, because I think everyone has in their head after last year's 11 billion euro budget that there's going to be this big mad giveaway. Now, I'm not saying that's not going to happen, because they said last year it wasn't going to happen, and look at what did happen. Yeah. But there seems to be a lot of emphasis on being prudent, and you don't know what's coming around the corner. But Stephen Donnelly's budget is a huge issue.
The window is closing to protect ourselves from the financial headwinds ahead, was what Michael McGrath said on this the other day. Niamh, you were looking at that, but you're also looking at the Offaly and the Sunday Independent, and this is, I think, part of the whole talking things down until they find a load of money down the couch in 9 days' time and suddenly give us a giveaway budget. Budget surplus likely to be slashed by up to 20 billion. So we were all in a massive row about how the 65 billion
after all. There's a lot of dampening expectations going on, and one of the strategies in that is revising downwards the forecast up to 2026, which makes it much gloomier. It's interesting, actually, also in the poll, the Ireland Thinks poll, which says, which of the following do you think the government should prioritise in the upcoming budget? 68% say measures to reduce cost of living, only 16% measures to reduce personal taxation. And I suppose, to me, that's a big challenge to Fine Gael, because that has been their kind of go-to running up to budgets. This is how we're going to look after our base. We're going to cut tax, but it doesn't seem to be that is landing.
Well, as suggested,
based on this on this particular poll. So, in that sense, I think at the end of the day, we are moving much more into an electoral focus now. Interestingly, this will be the first minister, Fianna Fáil minister for finance,
since Brian Lenihan.
Yeah. So I think that will be very much in Michael McGrath's mind when he stands up to give a speech on budget day.
So to push the idea that they are responsible now and they have learned their lesson.
You're the expert there
on Fianna Fáil and their history and everything.
Well, it's a big day for Michael McGrath. If Fianna Fáil will send a commissioner to Europe next year, he may or may not go.
And okay, so that, let me stop you there. So this was an interesting story, a kind of a kite you'd wonder or whatever in the Mail last week, which is suggesting that Michael McGrath has decided that if Micheál Martin is staying on as leader, he's not willing to hang around any longer and he wants the commissioner job. So you think there might be truth in that story?
Well, the truth is that Ireland will send a new commissioner to Europe next summer. That's the truth. Okay. They could ask Mairead McGuinness to stay on. That level of generosity to another would be uncharacteristic. It is apparently in Fianna Fáil's call. It's highly prestigious. A former Prime Minister and a current Deputy Prime Minister, Minister for Foreign Affairs, Micheál Martin, would be well placed to get a senior post. He would have a long shot at getting president of the European Council, depending on where his group in Europe, ALDE, the Liberal group, are after the European elections. But either Micheál Martin takes it or he leaves it to another. And if not Martin, who else? In which case, McGrath is clearly on a very short list of possible others.
Okay, seeing as you're kind of, I think you're in a very highbrow way now giving us some gossip that you're potentially hearing. So tell me this. There's a story, I forget where it is now, but today. Mail on Sunday,
Bertie O'Hearn one.
Yeah. Suggesting that Micheál Martin is not minded to go to Europe because if he did, he would be leaving the pitch clear for Bertie O'Hearn, who's travelling the country, apparently electrifying the chicken supper circuit and has his eye on the presidency.
Well, I haven't met the electric chickens myself. and Bertie is obviously very active and he has an awful lot to offer in the current context of Brexit. Today is the first operational day of the Windsor Agreement and he's sought after for his views because his views are very well.
A presidential campaign is a very different thing.
Well, he's never spoken to me about that. And I speak to him from time to time.
Okay.
And I'm aware of media speculation. And that's all I can say about it. Okay. I've never had a conversation with him about it, nor he has ever mentioned it to me.
And if it was the kind of thing he was thinking about, he possibly would have mentioned it to you, would he?
Not in the first instance, no.
Okay, I see. Yeah, even his friends, he keeps out of the distance.
I'm sure he'd keep his own counsel. But getting back to the budget, and if I could just mention the front page headline in the Business Post of a 2 billion overrun, that is a new figure because the figure given by Bernard Gloucester, the CEO of the HSE in a parliamentary committee, was 1.2 billion.
I've just been texted by a political source saying that 2 billion figure is not correct. Just this week, the HSE CEO told the Health Committee he expects the supplementary to be 1.1 billion. You beat me to it.
And to put the 1.2 billion in context, it is 4% of the gross figure for the health vote this year.
Yeah.
And to put the
Are you saying that in a positive way? I'm saying that
1.2 billion is an eye-popping figure that will absolutely dislocate other allocations, for sure. So that speculation is correct.
Yeah.
In context, it's about 4% of the total health vote. And in context, that whole total health vote of about 24 million is 39% up in 2017. So it's getting, the numbers are getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
We're not outliers.
You see, hang on a minute though. You're saying it's only 4%. If we go
No, 4%, I didn't say it was only 4%. I said it is context. 4%.
Okay, yeah, but context. But like, if everyone goes 4% over, there's our envelope for tax cuts. There's
Correct.
Our envelope for helping renters. You know, you can't...
And the issue about the health budget is the story behind the story, which is briefing to the effect that health were given a budget or health took a budget that was incapable of meeting the needs which it was allocated for. In other words, we were told in the Dáil on the record, the deputies in the Dáil who fulfilled their constitutional duty to allocate that public money to that vote, they did it on the basis of published plans, which were now being told, both Health and the Department of Public Expenditure, both knew to one extent or another, were inadequate to meet the purpose which they were allocated. There's a serious weakness in our system where these rickety, wrinkled budgets are being produced to pass on the day with nobody really believing they can get to the end of the year on. There's an issue, by the way, for the Oireachtas Committee on Health, which on our behalf has the responsibility to interrogate forensically these budgets, but which hasn't effectively done so. If you go back to 2011, when this government or an iteration of it came into power, Brendan Howlin, the then Minister for Public Expenditure, said that secretaries general who are accounting officers would go before the relevant policy ministers with their plans before the budgets, so that these could all be examined. Well, that's long gone, by the way.
I think the minister has been vaguely, or it's been said he's putting it out there that the budget was never enough in the first place. But are we not?
But
told
hold on
that,
a second,
are we not
Brendan.
Told
there's
that
a
the
major
extra money is to do with new initiatives, inflation and health. And then I think there was some element of possibly that was discretionary that could have been dealt with.
So
they shouldn't have done new initiatives then, should they? I mean, the point of a budget is you work within the budget, isn't
Correct.
It?
Correct. And the three elements were inflation, ageing, and initiatives from the HSE that should not have been undertaken. And
inflation, right? What does everybody else do? If somebody has 100 quid and if there's inflation, they still spend 100 quid. They just cut their cloth. But are we suggesting that because it's health, that they just need to spend what they spend.
Well, that's the culture, and that's what we're living with.
The problem, Brendan, is, and I hate this, is actually the structures in health. So if we look at Ireland in an international comparator, we have a very high spend health system, which is still, considering the spend, relatively poorly performing compared to other European countries. If we look, for instance, at education, our spend on education is moderate, but our performance in education is moderate and in some points of the system actually quite high. So I think the frustration that people have, I mean, the papers this week are riddled with, we're going to have an A&E crisis, we're going to have a trolley crisis, and money has not solved this one. I do think there's an issue, and in fairness, I think Bernard Gloucester, the new head of the HSC, has acknowledged this, that there is now questions about whether the HSC in its current iteration, in its current form, is actually best placed to manage the health system. I think there's a question mark there.
Pat, you wanted to come in there?
I think you have to look at it in context when you talk about the health sector. And we cannot ignore or forget that we've come through a pandemic, a global pandemic, which was a crisis. And in any crisis situation, you've several aspects to it. You have your planning and preparation, which prepares you actually to deal with it. You have your response at the time, and then you have your recovery and renewal piece. We're in the recovery and renewal piece now, and that always costs money. And what you said there about, you know, new initiatives, that's what the renewal piece is about. You never go back to where you were. You're not looking for, you know, to normal services. You want to be better than you were before you started, because some learning has to come out of a situation, and that costs money. So when we look at the spend in health, you have to take that into consideration. There was a context there that we have never endured before.
Okay. Louise, we won't dwell too much. We've mentioned the poll in the Sunday Independent. We won't dwell on it too much, but I think the takeaway suggested in this poll is that Sinn Féin are back to where they were kind of towards the beginning of the year after being off a bit. I think we saw similar in the Irish Times poll during the week.
Yeah, so Sinn Féin seem to be experiencing a bounce now. We know Marilyn MacDonald has returned after being unwell. And in the Sunday Independent Ireland Things poll today, they are up 2 points to 35, which it's quite impressive.
And give us everyone else.
Yeah, so Fine Gael are at 19, down 2. Fianna Fáil are at 17, down 1. Social Democrats, they're 5%, they're down 1. The Green Party, I'd say, are rejoicing this morning. They're 4% up 2. Labour,
which would be within the margin of error, I think, plus minus.
Don't take their
plus
win
or
away
minus
from
2.9%.
Them.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Labour are no change at 3. AIM2 are up 1 at 3. Solidarity down 1 to 2. And then up 2 for the Independents, who are at 12%. So it's broadly what people, I think, would expect, especially that kind of run away from Sinn Féin. They seem to be building that momentum in the run up to the local and European elections. What isn't interesting, actually, about this poll compared to the one that was in the Irish Times during the week is that the approval and disapproval ratings for the leaders. Micheál Martin is at 43%, still ahead of Mary Lou MacDonald, who's at 42%. So,
okay, give the other party leaders now.
So Holly Kearns is at 41, Leo Varadkar at 37, he's up 1 actually. Vanna Batchik of Labour, she is at 31%, she's also up 1. Pádraig Tobin of AIM2, he's at 28%. And then Eamon Ryan, again, another boost for the Greens, up 3 points to 21%.
Okay, Gerard, on the party leaders, it's been around now since Charlie Flanagan made his announcement that he will be not contesting the next election. The discussion again, exemplified in the Sunday Times headline, Claire Scott, Fine Gael forced to map out its future as Varadkar's allies head for the hills. Regeneration time in Fine Gael.
And I would read that story across with John Brennan's piece in the Mail on Sunday about a particular difficulty Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have in relation to women candidates in a forthcoming election where 40% of their candidates must be women. And if you're putting token candidates on a ticket in a situation where things are tight electorally in terms of your margins and you're splitting votes unnecessarily, you're more likely to get a kick down than a kick off.
Okay, and I don't think there's any suggestion that the women candidates would be token.
Oh, sorry. Well, let me make the suggestion, because I am sure that in the past women have been put on tickets as token candidates. I thought we all understood that.
Niamh?
It's interesting for me. I think the thing that isn't being named in the Mail's piece on gender is Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are still largely parties which are very dominant in rural areas. And the parties who are struggling less with the gender issue, such as Labour and the Greens and the Social Democrats, tend to be stronger in urban areas. There is, and this is kind of a lesson.
Is the atmosphere in politics conducive to, well, anyone wanting to go into it? No, but there's a
structural
seem to have a particular
problem. So, for instance,
if you're
a woman in your 30s and 40s and you have three small kids and you're thinking of running for politics, if you live in Dublin or in the Middle East, you can go home to your children every night. If you live down in West Cork, that's 3 days a week away from your kids if you're in Donegal. And like a lot of women don't want to do that. And so there is a structural... Now, politics more globally hasn't solved that particular conundrum.
Yeah,
but
okay.
it is a structural barrier. And we have seen over the years a number of successful women TDs move away from politics for precisely that
That's
reason.
That's very interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. Okay, we'll take a break. Gerard Howland, Niamh Horrigan, Pat Leahy and Louise Byrne staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Niamh, this was a talking point during the week. Leo's Benefit Street job was ill-judged and deeply offensive, Holly Cairns is writing in the Mail on Sunday.
Yeah, I don't think sometimes Leo has a kind of a slip and shows his roots having been a Republican intern, and this was definitely one of them. This particular controversy emerged in a debate around disability benefits and reform of disability benefits, and it's a kind of a trope of the right internationally that, you know, we have all these welfare cheats and benefit cheats. But the interesting thing, if you look at our unemployment statistically in terms of labour research, 4% unemployment is full employment internationally, right? Our employment level currently stands at 4.1%. So in an economy where there are loads of jobs available, people are taking those jobs. If you look at the, you know, between 2010 and 2012, we went from around 4% unemployment to 14% unemployment. Why? Because the economy contracted and people lost their jobs. So I do think, I was glad there was a kind of hostile response to it, but I think the broader...
Do you know, we do grade people according to the level of their disability in this country.
We do.
If you have a child with an intellectual disability, they will be brought into a person from the HSE who will then examine
correct.
Them to see if they are mild, moderate or severe and what level of services they should get and everything. So like to pretend that, well, you're either disabled or you're not, it's baked into the system at all levels, like,
exactly.
And it is a reality possibly of disability, that it is maybe it is a spectrum rather than being a black or white thing.
But also the danger is, and this has happened, and this is what emerged in the debate, some of these reform systems can be extremely punitive and extremely damaging. And it, particularly for Fine Gael, I don't know if you remember a local election a number of years ago where there was reform of medical cards. Mm. And all those letters went out 3 or 4 weeks before a local election, writing to people with long-term illnesses saying, are you, you know, you don't still need your medical card. The damage that was done to Fine Gael in that local election was tremendous.
Sure,
I mean, it was a slip in that context.
Well, Leo is a former Minister for Social Protection. We have 3.9%, 8% unemployment. I have absolutely no sense that there are large numbers of people in any category, including disability, undertake to get allowances in which basically keep them in a sort of poverty and not much more. In any and every system, there's always a few at something all the time. Is it a significant systematic problem? Absolutely not. That's my lived experience.
Okay. No, he did say, look, the truth is somewhere in the middle. He didn't suggest they were all like Benefit Street. He was also suggesting like that they weren't all like, what is it called?
I Daniel Blake.
Yeah. So that's what he would say, that he was just suggesting that the truth is in the middle somewhere,
sure.
And it's complex. Pat, there's a lot about the guards today. Which piece would you pick out as being interesting? The interview with the commissioner in the Sunday Independent,
where he
is baffled at how personalised the GRA have made an industrial relations dispute.
I suppose, look, that's an interpretation of it. For me, and if you go back to management in any
organisation... Is it a breakdown in some kind of... the kind of discipline you would expect in a kind of a... What is a hierarchical security organisation where there is a commander-in-chief, in effect,
yeah.
And that they've had a vote to say... We don't have any confidence in our leader. Would it not be if you join the army, wear the boots? Do you not? Is it not unquestioning that you accept the bona fides of your leader?
Yes, and that has always happened. So you have to ask the question: why now? What has gone wrong? And I think one of the things that is causing the difficulty at the moment is the reluctance or the failure to acknowledge that something is wrong. And that's it. And Conor Brady came out this morning in the Sunday Times, and he as much as says that, you know, he acknowledges there's something wrong here and we need another review, like the Conroy Commission, to address what's after happening here. And I suppose you have to look at it again in context. The Guards had, I think, about 48 hours notice to change their rosters coming into COVID, and ought to go from 8, 9 and 10 hour tours to 12 hour tours, 4 on, 4 off. They weren't asked if they wanted to. They were told, do this. So they did that and they went frontlining it with all the duties that they were normally doing, up close and personal with people, going to the scene of dead bodies, etc., like, and all, putting themselves in harm's way. There was no step down at the end of that that would suggest, look, okay, it's time for a rest now, guys, and we'll go back to this. And
I don't know that anyone got a rest. I don't know anyone in the public service got a rest after the
Well, it wasn't an option
pandemic.
For them to work from home or anything like that. So, yeah. But they were frontlining it from the beginning. They never questioned it. And we saw them, like, you know, they did their very best. We saw them dancing and taking groceries to people's homes and collecting medicine for people. Like, the huge community orientation that is natural to them. They're coming out the far side now and they've been party to a roster and they're saying, look, this really suits us, life, work-life balance-wise, you know, and we'd like to explore it further, or we'd like to discuss this.
And the Commissioner now, said he's open to compromise, well, and open to a conversation.
And that's fine, but look, he himself has come out during the week and said, but on the 6th, we're still going back to the one that they've acknowledged, the management team have acknowledged, is broken. Now, I'm very familiar with how that is broken, and the fixes were identified, but during a ballot, even though they were agreed around the table by all the associations, that we would apply the fixes and this would be a much better roster. A ballot with the GRA failed, even though their negotiating team accepted it. So look, that was the situation, and that was a 6-on-4-off roster. Some of the papers this morning are reporting it was a 4-on-4-off. It wasn't.
Yeah.
It was a 6-on-4-off. What they're on now is a 4-on-4-off. But look, irrespective of all of that, I don't think it was personalised. I think it's like addressing what's happening in a business. You never address it through the individual. You address it through the behaviour.
Okay.
Okay.
So, time is against us now. Yeah. Does anyone disagree with Pat and his views on the rank and file Gardaí's?
I don't disagree at all, but I think there's something else coming into the mix, which is that, you know, when we talk about a leader of a big organisation, usually is it, you know, they have to have the dressing room. But Drew Harris was not, you know, his appointment followed Martin Callanan, followed Noreen. There was a crisis in the Gard. He was not brought in really to have the dressing room, for want of a better word. And that subtext was always there with his appointment. Therefore, I always think, and the Guards, because of a whole range of issues, there is an issue around pay and conditions. But I think because of
Are you suggesting there's also an issue that an outsider has been brought into an insider culture, which is, I know, one of the areas you're interested in?
Yeah, and you see, he was brought in to do that. But I suppose I'm not sure it was thought through what the consequences would be when that leader essentially, at a certain point, like all organisations, the leader has to have the dressing room. And if you lose the dressing room, then it makes it really difficult to do this kind of nuts and bolts changes.
Very
that
briefly,
are needed.
It's been briefly. A traumatic 10 years for the Guards. And if it concludes by a third commission in a row having to go in untoward circumstances, the reputational damage to the Guards will be significant.
Okay. But there is no question of him going.
There is no question, but he's under pressure and he shouldn't be under pressure because I expect a uniformed service to follow a command structure.
Or do you think this has to be looked
at? And by the way, as a citizen, I would be deeply worried if I'm told that An Garda Síochána cannot be commanded.
I think this has to be looked at, though, in the context of recruitment and retention. We know that we're having issues getting people through Temple Moore, and then when you get them in, an awful lot of them seem to be leaving before they even pass out. And then the Gardaí who are already there, you're struggling to retain them. So I think it has to be looked at in that context as well. And how do you make sure that, yes, Drew Harris is happy, yes, the Garda management are happy, but also that you're managing to keep those Gardaí on the beat? Because that is a real issue, and we're seeing that exacerbated now at the moment as well.
Okay, and we are looking for more and more young people to go into the Guards. Listen, before we finish up, Niamh Horrigan, we had a world exclusive review of the U2's latest extravaganza from Dave Fanning yesterday. You're a big U2 fan. You've been reading the reviews today.
I was in my teens. Yeah. A great review of it. In a sense, this whole sphere, they're doing the sphere in Las Vegas, it's very much what U2 has become, which is kind of this global performance experience. It's not the U2 that I loved, which was Boy and War and October and kind of gritty Dublin stuff. Yeah. But nevertheless, that's where they are.
Black and white lights would have been red now and again.
Yeah. That was the height of it for me. This is not my particular cup of tea, but for, you know, good luck to them. If they make more billions, well, fair play to them.
People seem to be very impressed by it anyway, for sure. Louise, do U2 matter at all to your generation?
I mean, I'm sure it matters to some people. They kind of go over my head a little bit, other than I know a few of them live right the corner where I'm from, but I wouldn't know a huge amount about them, but I'm sure there are fans that are my age.
It's gas, isn't it, Niamh, that everything generations out, like
well, all the people in the papers.
You two are the only show in town.
It looks clad in the papers saying it's great are people in their 50s, which is kind of sad. I'm also in my
50s. Maybe there was only people in their 50s sent out to it to review it.
They could afford to go, Brendan.
Yeah, okay. Niamh, you made a walk earlier. Surely male politicians based, for example, in West Cork who are parents have the same childcare problems as females. Sure. And just one quick one here. I've been involved in a political party for 4 years, this texter says. The complete dominance of older male voices has been eye-opening. It directly affects who even gets selected to run the treatment of women who are brave enough to put their hands up to being involved. The only reason I haven't left is because I heard other parties are the same. Join a party, any party, it's as important as voting, because otherwise they have a completely disproportionate influence on the political ecosystem. So there is somebody saying, if we want to change it from being gammon in all the political parties, we need some fresh meat to get in there. Okay, that's it. Our panel today, Gerard Howland, Niamh Horrigan, Pat Leahy and Louise Byrne. Thank you all very much.